Hi, this is Queer Writers of Crime, and this is my monthly Authors Recommending Authors episode. This is an episode where recent guests give book recommendation, or recommendations, plural, for books that they think you should check out. David Peterson, Lev Raphael, and myself are the three individuals that are going to be telling you what we think you should read. And I also have some thank yous that are long overdue. That's all coming up right after you listen to this.
It's time to put on your sleuthing cap, feel nail-biting dread, and face heart-racing fear. This is Queer Writers of Crime, where you'll get book recommendations and hear interviews with LGBTQ authors of mystery, suspense, and thriller novels. Here's your host, Brad Shreve.
Hi, this is Brad, and welcome. Before we get started with the book recommendations, I'm long overdue in giving some shout-outs to some individuals. I've had some generous people making donations to the show, as well as some people that went to the effort to do some reviews of the show on Apple Podcasts. I'm going to start with those that have made donations. First, our most recent donations. One comes from Carl Emilia. Thank you, Carl. Another comes from Lori. Thank you so much, Lori. David and Alan also gave a donation, as well as a gentleman named Michael Kellett. Thank you to the four of you. I really appreciate you helping to pay for the show. As I always say, I'll be here no matter what, but anything to help pay for it certainly helps. As far as those making reviews, I've got some reviews. These folks left them on Apple Podcast, which is the primary place people go to check for show reviews. If you don't have an Apple phone, you can still go to iTunes, and all those will transfer over to Apple Podcasts as well. The first one comes from Nick J. Rick, and he says, "Wonderful show, must hear. I stumbled upon this since COVID when I began walking daily. As you can see, it's a little old. Brad is truly a wonderful interviewer and charms his guests completely. The review section by Justine is pure magic." He goes on to say some other things, but that narrows it down. Sailor Girl says, "Full and fun of great energy. Brad does an amazing job speaking with his guest, and the show is so entertaining. This unique show will open your eyes to much talent in the crime writing world." Swizzy2000, hello Swizzy, "gets behind the stories. Brad has an ability to really unlock the people behind the pen. He brings years of writing experience and expertise to the table. Great show." And the last one I have is from TGuyLCC. He says, "I'm a new listener, and I love the concept and the content. Great job." All of those are five-star reviews, and even if they weren't, I'd read them anyway, but that's all I have, so that's great. So that's it for the shout-outs. Thank you to all of you that I just mentioned, and kick back, and now we're going to listen to some book recommendations. David S. Peterson, it is time for your book recommendation, and I first want to hear, whose book are you going to recommend?
I am going to recommend Bud Gundy's book.
Bud Gundy. Excellent timing. Bud was on maybe a month ago, 3 weeks ago.
Oh, cool. I'll have to listen to that.
So good timing.
So I'm going to talk about his mystery, Somewhere Over Lorraine Road, which I've actually read twice now and found it just as entertaining as the first time. It was a really fascinating book, and I highly recommend it. I actually met Bud at the 2019 Lambda Awards in New York City. Both of our books were nominated for Lammies, and I was immediately taken with Brad's warmth, his charm, his intelligence, and was definitely compelled to download and read Somewhere Over Lorraine Road, which he had told me about. It was first released in 2018, I believe. And it is a compelling mystery. It's about three little boys who were murdered in 1975. And the story talks about why they were killed. And it's definitely a real page-turner. It's suspenseful, it's gripping, and it's at times heart-pounding. It's kind of what every good mystery should be.
Would you say it is gruesome without being titillating in that way?
Yes, I think that's a good way to describe it. Yeah, it's gruesome and it's disturbing, but it's not graphic and it's not titillating. The main character is Don Esker, and he's one of four sons of a middle class working couple. He grew up in the small fictitious Ohio town. I'm pretty sure it's fictitious. Couldn't find it on a map, of North Homestead, which is not to be confused with North Olmsted, which is a real small Ohio town. Don moves away to San Francisco from North Olmsted as an adult. And, you know, a lot of people from small towns did that. I did that, especially when they're gay, as Don is. So Don grew up in this small Ohio town, realizes he's gay, he's got to get out of there, and goes to San Francisco. But in the first chapter, Don's back home. He's visiting his parents. They're still living in the same house Don and his brothers grew up in across the street from former police chief Tedesco and his son Billy, which is Don's former best friend. And, you know, best friends were easy back then. The kid next door, across the street, the one who sat down next to you on the bus and shared a sandwich. You know, it didn't take a lot for kids to be best friends back then.
Nowadays, kids may not know the next-door neighbor at all, but they are on video games nonstop with the kid all the way across town or halfway around the world.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, absolutely. And in a way, that's kind of sad. You know, there was something kind of easy about hanging out in the backyard with somebody or playing hide-and-seek with the kid next door. So, but the story is told partially in flashback, and so it starts out in present day, and it flashes back to the year 1975. Don Esker was 10 years old. And I think really what is I found really fascinating is that Bud captures that time period perfectly. He describes the clothes, the cars, the houses, and just, you know, the reckless abandon of young boys of that era who were, you know, unlikely, like you said, the kids today with their video games. Those kids were without a care in the world. You know, it was hot summers between the school years. I remember the cutoff jean shorts and the tank tops, the longish hair parted down the middle. Oh my God, I had that feathered back. Right? Girls in bikini tops with a shirt over and the tails tied in a knot about their waist. Wood paneling, linoleum floors, lawn gnomes. You know, Bud brings back all those memories. Some good, some not so good, but all vividly captured in time, like a photograph or a whole movie. I mean, he does a really good job bringing that to life.
You sure just described an era I know really well.
Yeah, me too, right? Yeah, and Bud describes it really well. He makes the story really relatable, I think, as you just said, to anyone who grew up in the 60s and 70s, or, you know, even just anyone who remembers that time or enjoys nostalgia along with a good mystery. He really captures it, and I don't think there's a detail he got wrong. And I think the character of Don, the main character, I think he's instantly likable. At least he is to me. You know, he's the type of person I'd want as a best friend, or maybe was my best friend, that kind of a guy back then. He's a good guy. He's flawed. He's driven. He's conflicted. But he's honest, and I think he's really sincere. So Bud made him not your stereotypical gay. You know, he's not into fashion. He's not into decorating. He's not into the latest styles. He's just a guy who happens to be attracted to other men. And those are the kind of characters that I like. And so I kind of felt like I really related to him. And I think, you know, I think the book touches on those moments of self-discovery too, which we all went through. You know, those times that are etched forever in our minds. First same-sex crushes, first same-sex kisses, first loves. Those moments of shame, fear, guilt. And, you know, sometimes those things happen with our friend too, our best friends. But yeah, I think he touches on those moments really nicely too.
I haven't read this particular novel, but I have read some of Bud's other novels. And it doesn't surprise me in the least that you're talking about how good this book was. And what is the name of the book again?
Murder on Lorraine Road. And yeah, it's a murder mystery, which is my genre. And it starts, as I said, in present time, but it goes back to 75. And that's when these series of horrendous murders rocked the little town. It was three little kids, and they couldn't solve it. They didn't know who did it. And I think a challenge for any author, especially, you know, is going back and forth between present day and the mid-70s and early 80s. And I find that Bud does that effortlessly. I think flashbacks can sometimes be confusing and difficult to follow, but I think Bud did it really skillfully. And the action begins almost immediately. I mean, I think early on, I think it's in the second chapter, there's a scene set in 75 where Eddie, which is the younger brother of Don's best friend and the youngest son of Police Chief Tedesco, the kid gets locked in an old abandoned refrigerator. And I think we can all remember horror stories of kids suffocating those, people telling everybody to remove the doors before they discarded them. I'm sure your parents probably warned you to beware of them. I mean, it was huge back then, right?
I remember the commercial showing people to put chains around their refrigerators.
Yep. Take the doors off, chain them closed.
And if you're too young to understand what we're talking about, the old refrigerators, when you were inside, you were sealed. You could not get out.
Yep. Airtight. So it's a heart-pounding scene, and it's truly terrifying. And I don't think I'm spoiling too much of the book to say Eddie does eventually escape, but then he disappears a week later, and he's never found. And shortly after his disappearance, other boys begin to disappear, and they're eventually found dead. And as I said, they're murdered by an unknown assailant. And the residents of North Olmsted are just, they're thrust into a state of fear and panic, as you can imagine, everyone wondering who's responsible, and they're all eyeing each other nervously. Is it a stranger from out of town? Is it, you know, who is it? And when fingers eventually are pointed toward Don's father and he's interrogated by the police, even though there's no real proof or evidence, his life is ruined, as you can imagine, his reputation stained and tattered, and Don's family, as well as Chief Tedesco, is because he failed to find the guilty party and also failed to prove Don's father's innocence. It destroyed his family and ripped it apart. So the book, I think, touches on bigotry, touches on scandal, surviving being a social outcast, touches on grief, learning to forgive not only others, but also yourself, and finding peace. It covers a lot of ground.
And I will also say it sounds classic Bud Gundy, who loves to do multi-generational novels and the shift in time to cover different periods. So that sounds like Bud.
And he does it so well.
Yes, he does. Well, thank you so much, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Love, Raphael. I love hearing what authors read and what they recommend. And I gotta say, you probably are one of the ones, yeah, I think more than anyone else, I'm really excited to hear what you have to say, because I know how well-versed you are in other genres. I know how much you read. Sometimes when we're talking, you quote names I've never heard of. But I may have heard of them, but you know what they say about classics. Classics are books that everybody says are wonderful, but nobody reads. But you've read them all.
Or I tried. I mean, I have to tell you, I gave up on Ulysses many times. And finally, a professor of mine said, you know, I find one has to put more into the book than one gets out of it. And I thought, okay, I have permission not to read this book. Although I love his short stories. So there you go.
Well, who are you going to talk about? Okay, go ahead.
The book I want to recommend is The White Devil by Justin Evans. And I'm recommending it because it is an amazing gothic thriller that is homoerotic. So it hits a number of points. And it is one of the few books that I have actually read three times. And I think it's a classic and more people need to know about it. So let me ask you, what would be worse, thinking you saw a ghost or having it confirmed that you did actually see a ghost? In The White Devil, Andrew Taylor faces that creepy dilemma and a hell of a lot more. And his book ingeniously mixes literary detective work, a horror story, young gay love, academic satire, and cultural conflict between Americans and Brits. That sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But
it does sound. That's why I'm sitting here thinking that's a lot. That's not easy work to write that well.
It isn't, but Evans is terrific enough to keep all the balls in the air at the same time, pun intended. The White Devil is truly one of the most compelling thrillers I have ever read, and I have read a lot of thrillers. Now, the title is an obvious clue that you're signing up for a dark ride, because it's the name of a play by John Webster, one of those really grim Jacobean authors who wrote about ghosts and conspiracies and revenge. And the heart of this book is sinister revenge. Now, what happens in the book is the exact opposite of what Andrew Taylor wants, because he has come to an elite English school, Harrow, because he's screwed up big time at his previous prep school in America, and his father has given him one last chance to make good. Harrow only accepted this screw-up kid and screwed up kid because his father gave them a lot of money, which we know happens in real life. So Taylor is desperate. He needs a fresh start and good grades. He's got a problem that he never realized he would have. He bears a striking and unfortunate resemblance to Lord Byron, who attended Harrow 200 years before he did. And Byron left behind some real bitterness, some ghostly bitterness that reaches out from another dimension and tries to trap Taylor. I'm not going to say anything more about the plot because it'll blow people's mind. I will say that the writing in the book is so beautiful, so balanced, so appropriate to the material that despite the breakneck pace of the book, I really had to stop now and then to read passages aloud to my spouse or just to myself because I thought they were so gorgeous. I wanted to savor and share the excellence of a superb storyteller. And when it was over, I actually reread it. I spent a whole weekend rereading the book because I was so impressed by Justin Evans' gifts as a writer, as somebody who could range across so many different topics, weave them all together, and be as exciting as hell. And I have it on my desk because I'm planning on rereading it sometime this month or next month. And that'll make the fourth time. Read The White Devil by Justin Evans. It is amazing.
Well, what's interesting from what you said, it's kind of, I don't know if I like the term literary fiction because it's really kind of hard to define, but everything you listed was genre fiction.
Yep.
That he has in that novel, but it sounds like literary fiction.
It could be, yes. And I think one of the most interesting developments in publishing in the last 20 years, at least, is that literary fiction, quote unquote, has absorbed elements from genre fiction. I mean, murder is much more common in literary fiction than it used to be. And I think that's a good thing for writers and readers, not for crime statistics, obviously. So read the book, but don't emulate it.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Lev.
Thanks for asking me. I really love this book. And he's someone I wrote a fan letter to, and fan email to, and he wrote back. And, you know, I still do that. If a book touches me, I have to let the author know because they have probably been criticized at some point in their career, and everybody needs a boost. I know I do. And you having me on the show has really made my day, has made my weekend. So thank you.
Well, I'm honored. I'm choked up. I don't know what to say. But thank you.
Cheers. You take care.
You too. While I typically do the interviews on this show and leave the recommendations to others, I do dip my toe in from time to time, and I'm pleased I chose to do so in this particular episode. One of my new favorite authors, Anne McMahon, released her latest novel, Dead Letters from Paradise, a couple of days ago, before this episode released, which means whenever you're hearing this, it's available now to order. If you're not familiar with Anne, you can listen to her interview in episode 90, which was released almost exactly 1 year ago on June 28th, 2021. I'm going to start by reading a passage from her novel, and here it is. Together, we became one with the garden, our fresh young bodies twined together amidst the rows of young plants, feeling the warmth of the early summer sun on our backs and inhaling the sweet, intoxicating fragrance of the white rose of York, the sacred smell of heaven. We surrendered the first fruits of our youth, vitality, and promise to each other, and I tasted her freshness, laid bare before me in perfect harmony with all of nature. I imagined I was last seeing the face of God. Now, if you heard me on this show, you're likely shocked that I would read such drivel with glee, but that's not Anne's writing. Rather, it's the words a character in her novel wrote in a letter, a dead letter. The letters that wind up in a division of the post office in charge of researching undeliverable letters to find some clue who it should go to. And the journey is great fun. The novel takes place in an historic district in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, called Old Salem. I grew up from middle school to my early 20s, only 18 miles from there. And Winston-Salem is the home of the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, the maker of numerous brands of cigarettes, including the appropriately named Winston cigarettes and Salem cigarettes. The town of Salem was settled by Moravian religious community in 1766, and initially the church owned all the property and leased the land. All the people in the communities had to be members of the church and could be expelled from the town if they acted contrary to the community's regulations. Now, in 1913, the towns of Winston and Salem merged to become Winston-Salem, and then in 1950, Old Salem Incorporated was formed to protect the threatened buildings and restore the town, and the 70% of the buildings in the historic district are original. And Old Salem is a great place for tourists because it's a living, breathing museum, but it also has nearly 20,000 people still living there. And knowing which homes you can tour and which you can't are sometimes designated by quaint signs hung on the homes or fence posts, which simply say, "Do not disturb the residents." Now, is it necessary for you to know all this background to enjoy this story? Likely not, but I tell it because the protagonist in the story is Esther Jane Cloud, and more frequently she's referred to as EJ, and she is a resident of Old Salem, and it has significance in her thoughts and motivations of a 40-year-old spinster living in her ancestral home in Old Salem. And I'll admit, I'm probably a little overexcited and going off the rails here a bit, because my mom and I used to go to Old Salem at least twice a year, at least. And if for no other reason than to go to Winkler's Bakery, which is mentioned in the story. So back to the story. The year is 1960. A man named John F. Kennedy is running for president against Richard Nixon. Racial tensions are building across the nation. Four young men staged a sit-in at Woolworth's in nearby Greensboro, North Carolina, which started a sit-in movement that grew steadily throughout that year. And EJ, the protagonist, works in a dead-letter office in Winston-Salem and is a volunteer at the Hortus Medicus Garden in Old Salem. And I hope I got the name of that garden right. When the novel opens, Evelyn Hawes, the master gardener, thrusts the cardboard box at EJ with letters sent to the garden's address to a Miss Mary Jane Evans. Now, the Moravians have historically kept meticulous records, and no one named Mary Evans had ever worked or volunteered in the gardens. And so, the mystery begins. I love mysteries full of action, and if you listen to this show, you know I love a high body count. But that's not all I like. I enjoy any mystery as long as it's well written. So I'll tell you this, if you're seeking an action-packed thrill ride and that's all you want, you will be disappointed. But if, like me, you enjoy any good story told well, then you're in for a treat. Because the letters were actually delivered to the proper address, they technically aren't dead letters. But the master gardener's refusal to keep them puts EJ in an awkward position of taking them back to the post office. Now, EJ is not a rule breaker. She's uncomfortable for having to keep them in her personal possession for just a short time because it is against protocol. Now, at the dead letter office at the post office, EJ works with a black woman named Lottie. And Lottie gives us perspective of racism of the time, but McMahon does an excellent job of giving an understanding of the injustices during the era without beating us over the head with it. For instance, when there's a discussion about EJ's reluctance to take a train for the first time, Lottie points out that at least she can ride away from the engine noise and can eat in the club car, a point well taken by EJ. Later, there's a reference to Lottie judging a movie based on whether it's worth the flight of stairs to reach the colored section in the theater balcony. To me, these touches are perfect to give us just enough flavor of racism in the early 60s. But I'll give you a hint. The touches don't stay subtle as the story goes on. Lottie is the one who kind of is the catalyst because she takes one of the letters away from EJ and opens it. And the letters have a fragrant smell, and when they read one, they find it's a love letter from one woman to another. And I laughed out loud after Lottie read from the scented letter and said, "This has to be some white woman. Who else would write mess like this?" And there are a lot of good chuckles in this story. Maybe even a few bust out laughs, but mostly lots of good chuckles. There's good humor in this. Now, while we have the story of what to do with the dead letters, there is a secondary arc going on at EJ's home. She is a woman who typically keeps to herself, but is suddenly befriended by Faye Marion, a woman who lives in an apartment behind EJ's home. And despite EJ's reluctance, Faye successfully recruits her to help clean up the overgrown lot between their two homes. Faye is stocky, has frizzly hair pulled tight behind her head, and while EJ seems to enjoy getting to know someone, Faye has a friend named Inez who Faye tends to gaze a little longer than and is more affectionate with than EJ is comfortable with. Finally, to wrap up the cast of primary characters, I can't forget Harriet, better known as Harry. And Harry is a precocious 10-year-old girl who recently moved in next door and won EJ's heart. And she is sharp. With no way of knowing who the letter should go to and no return address to send them back, standard post office procedure at that point would be to destroy the letters. But EJ's co-worker Lottie gives her a nudge to continue, which is taken more seriously when little Harry comes up with some clues that are a long shot, but suggest the letters may come from a little southern Virginia town of Paradise. If it sounds like I'm giving too much away, don't worry. I would never do that. All of this is set up early in the story. A lot happens in a short amount of time, and the great thing is McMahon is skilled enough to present it to the reader without it being overwhelming or confusing. Another testament to Anne McMahon's skill is each character is well-developed, likable, even if they're not so likable, and damn believable. And as I read them, I felt I knew them personally. And I will tell you, having grown up in the South near this area, even though I was there about 20 years after these events happened, she has nailed it. You can tell Anne lives there. Again, back to the story. EJ and young Harry bond as they make journeys to Paradise, Virginia, following clues to find the anonymous sender. The quest to find who the letters belong to is not only a good vehicle for mystery and suspense, but also one of self-discovery. EJ is awakened to a world beyond the simple confines of her ancestral home. Her journey gives her a better view of racial injustice, as well as, air quotes, forbidden love. The story begins with a woman given a half dozen letters with nowhere to go, yet leads her to learn not only more about the world around her, but also about herself. There's much more I'd love to tell about the story, but each layer is the delight as it unfolds, and it's something each reader must experience on their own, and I am not going to take that away from you. All I'll say is the end of this unconventional mystery is deeply satisfying. And I'll add, as the host of this show, I try to stay neutral as much as possible, which is easy since I have so many outstanding authors as guests. But I'm bending my rules a little bit here, maybe a lot. I'm giving myself the freedom this week to suggest that if you only have time for one book the rest of the summer, Dead Letters from Paradise by Anne McMahon is the one to choose. You can't go wrong with this novel.
If you enjoy Queer Writers of Crime, let others know and leave a review. Who knows? Brad may just read yours on the air.